Welcome to the Beacon Broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church in Burlington, North Carolina, featuring expositional Bible teaching by Pastor Greg Barkman. If you'd like to correspond with the Beacon Broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201, or find us on the web at beaconbaptist.com. BeaconBaptist.com. The Beacon Broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. Now, with today's message from God's Word, here is Greg Barkman.
We are returning to Acts chapter 26 and to the account of Paul's testimony before King Agrippa. And of the several times that Paul gave a defense of his Christianity before kings and rulers, this perhaps is the most famous of them all because of the statement by Agrippa at the close of these proceedings when he indicated that Paul's words were so powerful that they almost persuaded him to become a Christian. What an amazing statement. And so we need to go back and pick up where we left off last Lord's Day. I am reminded that Paul was told at his conversion that part of what he would do as a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ is bear testimony before kings. And here's another example of it that was fulfilled a number of times in a number of different ways. But most of the time when Paul gave testimony before kings, it was as a prisoner. You know, someone had told me that you are going to minister to high-ranking government officials. I would probably have envisioned it as, as a prestigious event. Not quite sure how these things would come about, but it would probably be envisioned as something that was rather prestigious, that I was given opportunity to speak to high-ranking government officials. Who would have envisioned that this would be fulfilled as a prisoner, that the reason I was speaking to high-ranking government officials is because I was regularly hauled in before them on trial to give a reason for why there was such turmoil every place I went to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ. Well, that's what happened to the Apostle Paul. The promise of preaching before kings was fulfilled, but certainly not in the way that I suppose Paul would have envisioned it, since I don't know. He doesn't tell us what he envisioned when he was told these things. I can only speculate, trying to think what I probably would have done in that situation. But God's promise was fulfilled. It was fulfilled differently than probably Paul imagined. But isn't that the way that so many of God's promises are fulfilled in our lives? Isn't that the way that many of our prayer requests are fulfilled in our lives? We make requests. We have in our mind the way that that request ought to be fulfilled. We sometimes struggle with the fact that it doesn't seem to be being fulfilled at all, that God does not seem to be answering our prayer, and then, bang, He does fulfill it. He does fulfill our request, but in a way that is totally different from what we expected. And sometimes, initially, there's great disappointment there. Wait a minute, that's not what I had in mind. But if we are truly submitted to the sovereignty and wisdom of God, it doesn't take long before we begin to see that was an amazing fulfillment. God was exceedingly wise, not only gracious in fulfilling my request, but exceedingly wise in this unusual way that He brought it about, not the way that I would have imagined at all. That's often the way God deals with us. And the sooner we learn that, the better off we will be. Well, we need to continue in Acts chapter 26. Thank you for joining me on this Sunday, August 28, And thank you for remembering that we are dependent upon the gifts of radio listeners in order to continue teaching God's Word on this station. Well, what did Paul give in his standing, his defense, his opportunity to defend himself before Agrippa and Felix as well, you recall? Both were involved in this. Agrippa was actually there, not Felix, but Festus. Agrippa was there at the invitation, you might say, of Festus. So this is a wonderful opportunity. Paul is bearing testimony before two exceedingly high-ranking officials in the Roman government. And in verses 4 through 8, he gives his personal background. In verses 9 through 11, he gives his professional background. In verses 12 through 18, he tells about his conversion. And that's where we're going. We actually covered most of his personal background last Lord's Day. Let me simply read the verses, and then we can move on. Paul says, "My manner of life from my youth, which was spent from the beginning among my own nation at Jerusalem, all the Jews know. They know me from the first, if they were willing to testify, that according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers. To this promise, our 12 tribes earnestly, serving God day and night, hope to attain. For this hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused by the Jews. Why should it be thought incredible by you that God raises the dead?" So his personal background is intertwined with an account of what it is that seems to be the sticking point, the main point of controversy between Paul and the Jews, at least as Paul understands it and as he wants Agrippa to understand it. So Paul makes it very clear that though it is the Jews that are persecuting him and prosecuting him in this case, he is a Jew like they are. He makes it clear, though the Pharisees seem to be very much involved in this, no doubt along with Sadducees, but the Pharisees were very angry with him, that he himself was a Pharisee. And he makes it clear that the primary issue between himself and the Jews hinges upon his understanding of the doctrine of the resurrection. And he also makes it clear that most of the Jews believe in resurrection. Sadducees, of course, did not. But most of them did. The Pharisees certainly did. So what's the big problem? When you think about it, Paul believes what most of them believe. Why are they so angry with him? Well, of course, the problem is that Paul believes that Jesus was raised from the dead. And they don't. They believe in the doctrine of resurrection, but they don't believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, or they certainly don't want to believe that. You wonder how many of them secretly entertained suspicions that maybe he did. Like I read an article recently about indications that some atheists secretly entertain the thought that there really is a God, but they don't want to consider it. They push it aside because they don't want to deal with that possibility. And I think that's very true. I think that's very true. That people who deny that there's a God aren't really sure about that denial, but they want to be. So many times they're very adamant because they don't want there to be a God. But that's not the same thing as there not being a God, or not the same thing as there not being evidence for a God. And it seems to me that there's a whole lot more evidence for the existence of God than there is evidence that would deny the existence of God. People who deny the existence of God really aren't dealing with evidence so much as they are with their own unwillingness to accept the possibility that there is a God, because, of course, that means they'll have to be accountable to him. And it's a similar thing here with the Jews. They believe, they defend the doctrine of the resurrection, but they just don't want to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, because they don't want to deal with the implications of that. If Jesus rose from the dead, then Jesus must be the Messiah, as he claimed to be. And they don't want that result. They don't want to consider that possibility. They don't want anyone to press that claim upon them or to proclaim that message to others. They are determined to suppress every possible proclamation of the message that Jesus rose from the dead. And of course, that's what Paul did primarily, was preach the message that Jesus rose from the dead. So given this situation, is it really surprising that there was such a great conflict between them? So when Paul says to this promise, the promise of the resurrection, back to verse 12, our 12 tribes earnestly serving God day and night, hope to attain. Isn't that the truth? Jews, Paul says all of them, 12 tribes, all of them. Jews generally are entertaining hope of a resurrection, a future resurrection for themselves. They hope to attain to it. That's what they're doing. They hope to attain. For this hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused by the Jews. Well, what's the connection? What's the connection? Are you making a connection that's not really there, Paul? I mean, it's one thing to say that I believe in the doctrine of the resurrection and I am hoping to attain unto the resurrection, but why? What's the connection here? Why are you being accused by the Jews for this hope's sake? If, Paul, you also, like them, believe in the doctrine of the resurrection and hope to attain to the resurrection from the dead someday, then what's the problem? Why are you saying that for this hope's sake you are being accused by the Jews? Well, make the connections, because Paul is preaching that the only possible way to attain to the hope of the resurrection, which they all entertain, is to believe in Jesus, that he died and rose again from the dead. And those who believe in him will be raised to life, as Jesus promised. I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Paul did. There was a time when he didn't. There was a long time when he didn't. But by circumstances which he will later describe, he had come to believe exactly that, and he realized that the only way to attain to the resurrection from the dead, the hope that they were all attaining, were all entertaining, hoping to attain to, was to believe in Jesus Christ and his resurrection from the dead, and they didn't want to believe that. So that became the sticking point. Paul was saying, you want to believe, you want to be raised from the dead? The only way to do that is to believe in Jesus, who is the first fruits. He's the one who was raised from the dead first. And you've got to believe in him if you're going to be raised from the dead. And they said, no. We will not accept Jesus as our Messiah. But they wanted to go on entertaining hope for the resurrection of the dead. So you can see why this is such a critical point. It really is at the center of everything. And then Paul cries out in verse 8, why should it be thought incredible by you that God raises the dead? Perhaps he saw a flicker of incredulity on the face of Agrippa as he was saying this, as if Agrippa was saying, oh, come on now, stop talking nonsense. Don't tell me that you, a well-educated, intelligent man that you are, Paul, that you believe in such a thing as dead people being raised to life. Agrippa didn't say it, or at least it's not recorded, but it's interesting that Paul comes right back with this question. Why should it be thought incredible by you that God raises the dead? Indeed, that's a good question for all of us to ponder. Why do you think that's incredible? Some of you, perhaps listening to this broadcast, who are in that category, that find that just a little bit beyond the realm of reason and possibility. Well, if you believe that God is who he says he is, as the Bible reveals him to be, why should that be thought incredible? If God has the power to speak the worlds into existence simply by the word of his mouth, then why would it be difficult for him to raise the dead? And all of the objections that people come up to, well, how's he going to raise these bodies from the dead? They've decayed. How's he going to raise bodies to life that of people who died at sea and were thrown overboard, and they were eaten by sharks, and maybe a lot of different sharks, and some pieces of their body went this way, and some went that way, and many parts of their body ended up in the body of the shark. They became material for the growth and sustenance of the shark, and their bodies don't exist anymore except now in the shark, and then the shark dies. And I mean, you can raise all kinds of objections to belief in bodily resurrection, all these things that make it sound like, from a scientific standpoint, it's impossible. But of course, from a scientific standpoint, creation is impossible, right? From a scientific standpoint, from a strictly scientific standpoint, from what we are able to observe in this universe and to perform in laboratories and controlled experiments and to repeat for confirmation, which is the way science is carried out, of course. Nothing wrong with that. Everything right with that. That's good as far as it goes. But the problem is when the assumption is made that this is the totality of reality, that this is all there is. When you start asking questions like, well, where did all this come from? When you really consider creation, you have to realize that was a necessary event to bring things into existence that didn't exist before, and it can very well be, we would expect it to be, a unique event never to be repeated, which of course makes it outside the realm of science and scientific methods as we generally conceive of them. You're looking for something in the wrong place. You're looking for proof of something that is outside the box of your parameters of what you declare necessary in order to be convinced of the proof. But it's all a matter of definitions. You have carved out certain assumptions, presuppositions, definitions, and parameters, and said, we will only consider the things that fit inside here. And as long as you do that, of course you'll never understand creation, because it precedes all that and it's outside all of that. It doesn't fit those parameters, which are useful and helpful for scientific investigation, but aren't big enough to take into account this other reality, this greater reality. And that's what Paul is really saying here. Why should it be thought incredible by you that God raises the dead? If God is God, if God is the creator of this universe, and if he's not, then nobody has actually come up with a truly reasonable alternate explanation. I'm sorry, but nobody has. I mean, all of the theories that have been propounded, the Big Bang theory and various things, but they never really explain it completely. They're put out as theories, but they don't really, they aren't provable either. Isn't it interesting that the people who won't accept the testimony of God himself, that he did this in the beginning, well, we can't prove that. Well, you can't prove the Big Bang theory either. It's a theory. You can't prove it. Well, we'll accept that. Why? Because we like that. But it really, I mean, when you really push it back, there's just a lot of problems here. And one of them is, well, where did the original material come from that exploded into the universe? This Big Bang that supposedly catapulted all of these elements out through the universe. I mean, really, when you start thinking about that, what is out there in the universe, this must have been one huge mass of material. You start talking about all the material that's out there in the universe, and it's all there because something went bang, but that still doesn't answer the question, where did that material come from? Is that matter eternal? Well, that doesn't fit very well with what we know about science. We see things that are always disintegrating and wearing out and dissipating. We're being told that the sun is burning out. One of these days, planet Earth is going to be as cold as a glacier because the sun is going to burn out. Of course, it's going to happen so many millions or billions of years down the road that this is nothing that anybody living has to worry about now, but that's the scenario that we're painted, which no doubt is correct given the evidence that we have, assuming, of course, that everything is going to continue according to the processes that we can now observe and according to the same rate of processes, and that nothing will alter or change that. These are all assumptions, of course. Then the sun, which has enormous capacity to burn and burn and burn and burn and burn. The amount of fuel that's involved is beyond our imagination. That's just one of multiplied millions of suns just like that. But it is eventually going to burn up all that fuel and burn out. It's gradually going to cool. And then there will not be enough light or heat to sustain life on planet Earth. And planet Earth is going to become a glacier, assuming a lot of things. But again, scientific methods brought into play here. But okay, if that's what we observe, then how do you explain this process that did the opposite, that produced this huge bang of this mysterious material that we don't know where it came from in the beginning? We've got to take that by faith. And then it produced this huge bang, and it thrust all of these planetary objects, suns and planets and galaxies, out into space and started all of these processes going that we can now observe, and did all of this, placing everything in such perfect order. You can't duplicate that in the test tube, in the classroom, in the laboratory. Even considering the possibility of such an immense explosion that is beyond anything that our minds can conceive, explosions don't produce order. They produce chaos. They produce junk. They don't produce order and complexity, and they don't produce what we see. We can't make an explosion on Earth do anything like that, even on a smaller scale, to duplicate what we're being told has accomplished this in the universe in which we live. It just doesn't work that way. We can't make it work that way. That's not what we observe. That's not what we see. That's not what we reproduce. It just doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. I've often said that one of the reasons I don't believe in evolution, and I'm talking about certain phases of evolution now as I'm describing this, one of the reasons I don't believe in evolution is it takes too much faith. The evolutionist says the reason, the atheistic evolutionist says the reason he doesn't believe in God is because it takes too much faith. Well, I look at what he's asking us to believe, and it seems to me like that takes way more faith. Because he's asking us to believe that without a divine being, without a divine power, without an intelligent designer and guider of all of these things, that this stuff happened to produce such beauty and complexity and order, but we don't observe any of that in the world in which we live. It takes too much faith for me to believe that an explosion can produce that sort of thing. Several years ago, when I was in South Africa, I was invited to speak to a public school chapel program. Can you believe it? I don't know if that would still be possible today, but at the time I did it then, it was not possible in the United States, but it was possible there. It was welcome there. And here I was, a visiting pastor from America, and so I was treated well and something of a little bit of a celebrity, and asked to speak to this chapel of about 1,000 students from basically kindergarten through sixth grade, and I won't take time to describe what I saw, which was quite amazing. But I had to think long and hard, what in the world am I going to say to hold the attention of students ages 5 through 12? That's not my usual congregation, is it? And I decided an object lesson would be the best thing, and I happened to have with me an ink pen that had been given to me by a member of my church, and he made these things. He bought the working mechanisms, the mechanical parts, and then he made these beautiful wooden barrels, and he put all these, and he took the pieces from the kit, and he put it all together, and he produced beautiful ink pens, every one unique, no two alike. And he had given me one, and I happened to have it with me. I carried it along, so I said, this is a good idea. And I held it up, and I said, let me tell you the story of my ink pen. I said, I was walking out in the forest one day, and there was a storm that came up, and a bolt of lightning struck, and it hit a tree near me. And after the ground shook and the smoke cleared, I went over and looked at the base of the tree, and lo and behold, here was this pen lying there. It had evidently been produced by this lightning bolt. And I could see by the looks of the faces of the kids that they were looking at me like, I don't believe that. And of course, that was exactly the reaction I wanted. And I said, no, that isn't what happened either. I just told you that to get you thinking. If there is a pen, I said, you don't know who made this pen. I do. He's a member of my church. But if there is a mechanism, just a simple little mechanism like this pen, one thing is clear, there had to be a pen maker. If there is a pen, somewhere there is a pen maker. It was just a variation on a common argument for the existence of God, usually spoken in terms of if there is a clock, there's a clock maker. Well, I said, if there's a pen, there has to be a pen maker. Now, you don't know anything about him, but I can tell you about him, and I told a little bit about the man who made it. And it's the same thing. We see this world around us. You may not know who made it, but it's obvious somebody did. Now, let me tell you about him. Let me tell you about the God who made it. Well, until next week, this is Greg Barkman saying good day. May God give you his eternal peace.